Welcome to the History Maps Podcast. You know, you draw a bold line across a piece of paper, and it looks permanent. You point to a territory and declare, this is ours, and this is how it works. That is the expectation of map-making, really. Precision, order, engineering.
Right. It creates this clean, definitive illusion of control. We rely on visible borders to impose order on a chaotic world.
But when you look at the reality of colonial empire building in Southeast Asia, that map is exposed as a fragile piece of paper attempting to contain a hurricane. We are examining a geopolitical landscape today that is murky, violent, and deeply complex.
Because drawing lines over ancient fluid societies, it does not erase their complexities. It compresses those societies into an administrative pressure cooker until they eventually explode.
And that explosion is what we are unpacking today. So as part of our Southeast Asian history series, we are tearing down the complex, turbulent, and ultimately doomed history of French Indochina. For you listening, whether you are catching up on regional history or just deeply curious, this deep dive is going to guide you through the intricate mechanics of colonial empire building.
We will be exploring the precise machinery of economic extraction, the layered administration, and the highly organized, ideologically driven resistance that would ultimately destroy the very system that created it.
Now, to understand that destruction, we first have to define what French Indochina actually was. Because it was not a single unified country, right?
No, not at all. It was a layered federation officially forged on October 17, 1887. And it initially comprised Cochin China, Annam, Tonkin, and Cambodia.
And then Laos was added later.
Right. Laos was added as a protectorate in 1893. And eventually they added the least Chinese territory of Guangxuan.
So the French did not just conquer a landmass and treat it all uniformly. They engineered this tiered system of administration.
Yeah, they applied very different labels and different rules to different regions. So Cochin China, which covers southern Vietnam and the Mekong Delta, that was annexed outright in 1862.
And that was designated a direct colony.
Yes. Meanwhile, Annam in central Vietnam, Tonkin in northern Vietnam, the Kingdom of Cambodia, and eventually Laos, those were classified as protectorates.
Okay, so let's break down that distinction between a direct colony and a protectorate, because that seems like the foundational mechanism of French control here.
It absolutely is. In a direct colony like Cochin China, the French entirely eradicated local sovereignty. I mean, they imposed their own civil administration, they installed French courts, and levied taxes directly upon the population.
The land basically became legally French soil.
Exactly. But in a protectorate, the approach is more insidious. Nominal native monarchies were kept on their thrones.
Right, like the Nguyen emperors in Vietnam or the king of Cambodia.
Yeah, they kept their palaces, their titles, their royal robes, you know. But they operated under the suffocating supervision of French authorities.
But why bother with this tiered system at all? I mean, why not just sweep the board and make the entire region one uniform colony?
Well, it comes down to a really cynical calculation of efficiency and optics. Cochin China was the economic engine. The Mekong Delta was incredibly fertile.
Right.
So treating it as a direct colony allowed for immediate, unhindered exploitation of the land and the waterways.
But if they had tried to do that everywhere.
Exactly. If the French had attempted to completely dismantle the deeply entrenched monarchies in Annam and Cambodia outright, they would have triggered massive, sustained, and incredibly expensive revolts.
They would have needed hundreds of thousands of troops just to hold the territory.
Precisely. By utilizing protectorates, the French maintained a theater of traditional authority. It drastically reduced their administrative and military burden.
I see. So the local kings and the traditional class of mandarins, those are the Confucian-educated civil servants who historically managed the state, they were essentially transformed into a buffer.
That is exactly what they were. They absorbed the anger of the peasantry, collecting taxes and enforcing laws, while the French dictated all actual policy from behind the curtain.
And the person pulling those strings was the governor general.
Right. This was a position centralized in Hanoi. The French actually moved the capital from Saigon to Hanoi in 1902 to project power closer to the Chinese border.
And this governor general wielded supreme military, legislative, and judicial power over the entire union.
He was appointed directly by the president of France and acted as an absolute autocrat on the ground. I mean, he issued decrees, deployed military forces, managed the overarching budget.
And beneath him sat the French resident superiors in the protectorates, who whispered, or I guess rather shouted, orders into the ears of the local kings.
Yeah, shouted is probably more accurate. And this architecture created a bizarre, deeply unjust legal dualism.
How so?
Well, if you were a French citizen or a European expatriate living in Saigon or Hanoi, you lived under the Napoleonic Code. You were tried in French courts with French judges.
But the millions of local inhabitants?
They were subject to customary laws. But the application of that customary law is where the system's hypocrisy becomes really stark.
Meaning the rules change depending on who is involved.
Exactly. If two Vietnamese farmers had a dispute over a property line, the colonial state allowed local magistrates to settle it using traditional Confucian legal principles.
But what if a local challenged colonial authority?
The moment that happened, or say a European merchant accused a local worker of theft, the French legal apparatus immediately superseded customary law.
So the local was dragged into a system designed entirely to protect the colonizer and punish the colonized.
Yes. It is a system that shielded the European minority while keeping the indigenous population in a subordinate, tightly controlled legal status.
Think about what this does to the people actually living there. Because for centuries, this region operated with fluid ethnic and tributary networks.
Right. You had highland tribes shifting alliances, trade routes following rivers rather than arbitrary lines on a map.
There were overlapping spheres of influence between the Vietnamese, the Khmer, and the Siamese. And the French just disregarded all of that.
Entirely. They drew rigid borders based on their own strategic defense needs and resource extraction priorities.
So by locking these fluid societies into administrative boxes, they grouped historically hostile factions together and sliced interconnected communities in half.
They froze natural societal evolution. And these artificially frozen borders laid the groundwork for intra-regional conflicts that would explode long after the French Empire collapsed.
We really have to look at the individual who turbocharged this extractive machinery, though. Paul Dahmer.
Yes, Dahmer.
He arrives in Indochina as governor general in 1897. And when he steps off the boat, he finds a colonial administration that is just bleeding money.
Right. The territories are running massive deficits, costing the French taxpayer millions of francs annually. And you have to understand, Dahmer was not a military conqueror.
He was a former minister of finance in France, right?
Exactly. He viewed Indochina entirely as a balance sheet that needed to be brought into the black. His mandate was to put the colonies on a paying basis, and he brought a terrifying, ruthless efficiency to the task.
Because before Dahmer, the colonial administration was disjointed. Each region was handling its own finances and doing it poorly.
Yeah, Dahmer centralized the entire financial apparatus. By 1898, he forced a common budget onto the whole union.
This structure feels identical to a hostile corporate takeover.
It really does.
Like, France is the parent company. It acquires these regional entities. It turns Cochin China into a wholly owned subsidiary to maximize immediate agricultural profit.
And it keeps Annam, Tonkin, and Cambodia as franchised branches.
Right. Retaining the old branding, the local kings, so the local population doesn't entirely revolt. But then the parent company forces these acquired territories to foot the massive bill for their own subjugation.
That corporate restructuring analogy is highly accurate. Dahmer was essentially the specialist sent in to make the acquisition profitable.
And to do that, he had to squeeze the local population dry.
He did. He took direct control of tax collection. In the protectorate of Annam, for instance, the French entirely took over the treasury and simply paid the Vietnamese emperor a fixed allowance.
Wow, so that move stripped the monarchy of its last vestige of real authority. The power of the purse.
Exactly. Which brings us to the core function of French Indochina. It was officially designated as a colony d'exploitation.
A colony of economic exploitation.
Yes. And this is a crucial distinction from a settlement colony. Take French Algeria, for example, where large populations of French citizens relocated to settle permanently, farm the land, and build generational homes.
Indochina was never intended for massive European settlement.
No. By 1940, there were only about 34,000 French civilians living in the entire region, and that is sitting on top of an indigenous population of roughly 23 million.
So you have this microscopic elite layer of French administrators, military officers, and businessmen dictating the lives of 23 million people. How exactly did they extract the wealth?
Well, Dahmer instituted heavy regressive taxes, including a capitation or head tax on every adult male. But the real mechanisms of wealth transfer were the state monopolies.
the monopolies on opium, salt, and rice alcohol.
Right. And the selection of those three specific goods is deeply revealing. Salt is a biological necessity. In an agrarian society heavily reliant on preserving fish for protein, salt is life.
And rice alcohol.
It was not just a beverage. It was deeply intertwined with local religious rituals and ancestral worship.
So by monopolizing these daily necessities, the colonial state guaranteed an inescapable revenue stream from every single household.
Precisely. They criminalized independent salt panning and local alcohol distillation. If a peasant made their own traditional rice wine, they were legally a smuggler subject to arrest.
And then there is the opium monopoly, which is just staggering. By the 1920s, opium sales accounted for up to 20% of the entire colonial budget.
The government was functioning as a state-sponsored narcotics cartel. Yes. The French administration purchased raw opium, refined it in state-owned factories in Saigon, branded it, and sold it through thousands of licensed franchise dens.
They were producing over 80 tons of refined opium yearly by the 1930s. They funded the subjugation of the population by deliberately addicting them to narcotics.
That is the colony d'exploitation model at its most naked. But, you know, the extraction wasn't just fiscal, it physically altered the landscape.
Right. In Cochin China, the French initiated massive infrastructure projects to expand agriculture.
Yes. Between 1880 and 1930, they dug 1,800 kilometers of canals through the Mekong Delta, quadrupling the acreage devoted to rice cultivation.
Now, if you look strictly at the ledgers in Paris, this looks like an economic triumph.
Oh, absolutely. Rice exports skyrocketed, transforming Indochina into the third largest rice exporter in the world. They were moving 1 million tons annually by the 1930s.
But when you look at the reality on the ground, a devastating paradox emerges. Because despite a fourfold increase in agricultural land and record-breaking harvests, the individual Vietnamese peasant's rice consumption actually decreased during this exact same 50-year period.
It is a stark reality.
How does a region produce exponentially more food while its own people starve?
Because that newly drained and irrigated land was never given to the peasants who dug the canals. The colonial government auctioned the massive new tracts of land to the highest bidders, or sold them at nominal prices to French speculators.
And to a specific group known as the comprador elite. We need to define that term. What exactly is the comprador elite?
The comprador elite were local, indigenous merchants, landlords, and bureaucrats who acted as middlemen and agents for the European colonizers.
So they accumulated massive wealth by collaborating with the French.
Yes, managing the rural estates and facilitating the export economy. This dynamic created a severely polarized society.
You had a tiny class of wealthy, absentee landlords living in European-style villas in Saigon, and a massive, swelling underclass of landless tenant farmers.
And those tenant farmers were trapped in a brutal cycle of jet peonage. They worked the fields, but had to hand over up to 60% of their crop as rent to the absentee landlords.
So they grew the rice, the landlords took the bulk of it, and the French shipped it out of the port of Saigon to feed global markets.
That is exactly how the machine worked. And the exploitation expanded even further with the dawn of the 20th century and the automobile boom in Europe.
Ah, rubber.
Yes. The massive demand for rubber tires led French firms, particularly Michelin, to carve gargantuan rubber plantations out of the jungles of Cochin China and Annam.
The human cost of this rubber boom is terrifying
because
the plantations relied heavily on the corvée labor system.
Right, which was an ancient practice that the French modernized and intensified. It mandated up to 30 days of unpaid forced labor annually per adult male. It was effectively a labor tax.
The mechanics of this labor system were horrifying. Men were recruited well, often coerced or kidnapped from the overpopulated northern villages of Tonkin.
And then shipped south to the malarial jungles of Cochin China. They were contracted for 3 to 5 years, working 15-hour shifts, tapping rubber trees.
With almost no medical care, no mosquito netting in high malaria zones, and meager rations. And the enforcement was brutal. Overseers routinely used corporal punishment to maintain quotas.
The mortality rates were apocalyptic. On one single Michelin plantation site between the two world wars, 17,000 workers died from malaria, malnutrition, dysentery, and physical abuse.
17,000 human beings worked to death just to provide rubber for European cars. I mean, you are fundamentally dismantling a subsistence farming culture, forcing them into a monetized, export-driven economy, stripping them of their land, taxing their necessities, and subjecting them to lethal labor conditions.
And this completely warped the social fabric, leading to a stark spatial segregation in the cities.
You are talking about the dual city model.
Yes. If you walked through Hanoi or Saigon, you were presented with wide, tree-lined boulevards, grand colonial architecture, opera houses, and modern sanitation.
But this European quarter was an incredibly small, exclusive bubble.
Exactly. In Hanoi, Europeans never constituted more than 5% of the population, yet they occupied one-third of the city's prime real estate.
And just beyond those manicured boulevards, in the dense, overcrowded native quarters, you had extreme poverty, lack of basic sanitation, and rampant disease.
The wealth generated by the colony was highly visible, but completely walled off from the people actually generating it.
Now, to push back a bit, I am sure defenders of colonialism at the time pointed to the infrastructure projects. The completion of the Hanoi-Saigon Railway in 1936, the massive Long Bien Bridge spanning the Red River, the modern deep-water ports.
Right. The French administration heavily promoted those. They framed this as the mission civilizatrice, the civilizing mission. They argued they were modernizing a backward region.
But look at the actual utility of that infrastructure. The railways were not designed to connect Vietnamese villages or stimulate local domestic commerce, were they?
No. The tracks were laid specifically to move coal from the mines in Tonkin to the coastal ports. They were built to expedite the extraction of rubber and rice.
The modernization was entirely extractive, serving the global market and the French treasury.
And you cannot subject tens of millions of people to that level of systemic, violent exploitation without generating intense, escalating resistance. The pressure was building from the exact moment the French arrived.
The early resistance, however, looked very different from the revolutionary movements we see later. It was highly traditionalist.
Yes, between 1885 and 1896, the most significant movement was the Kenvung, which translates to aid the emperor.
And this was led by regional mandarins and scholars, most notably Fan Yin Fung.
To understand the Kenvung, you have to understand the mandarins. These were the educated elite, steeped in Confucian philosophy, who had passed rigorous civil service exams to administer the country under the emperor.
So when the French imposed their administration, these traditional elites viewed it as a catastrophic disruption of the natural moral order.
Their insurgency was royalist. They did not want a modern republic. They wanted to expel the French and restore the Ningyen emperor to absolute, unquestioned power.
They waged a decentralized guerrilla war, ambushing French patrols in the central highlands and attacking supply lines.
Concurrently, you had figures like Ho Hang Hotam, known as Etam, leading a separate highland guerrilla war in the rugged mountains of Tonkin.
He blended anti-colonial resistance with traditional banditry, using the dense terrain to completely frustrate French pacification efforts for nearly 30 years.
Right, up until his assassination in 1913. And these movements were fiercely courageous, but they were structurally doomed.
Because they lacked modern weaponry, they were regionally fractured, and they were fighting a highly industrialized European military.
True, but their biggest weakness was ideological.
Because the peasantry, who were doing the actual fighting and dying, had no real desire to bleed simply to restore a feudal monarchy that had historically oppressed them anyway?
Exactly. The promise of returning to the old Confucian hierarchy did not resonate with a farmer who was currently starving under French taxes. The resistance needed a modern ideological framework.
This triggers an evolution. Enter Phan Boi Châu in the early 20th century. He recognizes that fighting modern French artillery with outdated rifles and feudal ideals is suicide.
So in 1905, he launches the Go East movement. Phan Boi Châu was deeply influenced by the geopolitical shock of the Russo-Japanese War in 1905.
Where an Asian nation decisively defeated a major European empire.
Yes, it completely shattered the myth of innate European supremacy. Phan Boi Châu realized that Vietnam had to modernize its education and its military tactics to survive.
So he began smuggling Vietnamese youth to Japan to study modern sciences and revolutionary strategy.
The French diplomatic apparatus eventually pressured Japan to deport these students, shutting the movement down. But the conceptual seed of modern nationalism was planted.
And then the entire global order was fractured by World War I.
World War I is the absolute catalyst for the radicalization of Indochina. As the French military was being bled white on the Western Front, Paris demanded staggering sacrifices from its colonies.
Financially, the colonial administration squeezed Indochina for 184 million gold francs through massive war loans and increased taxation.
But the human toll is what truly shifted the psychological landscape. Between 1915 and 1918, the French conscripted and shipped roughly 93,000 Indochinese men 10,000 kilometers away to France.
Around 49,000 were forced into factories to manufacture munitions, while the rest were drafted into combat battalions, thrown into the meat grinder of the Somme and Verdun.
The psychological impact of this massive deployment really cannot be overstated. These young men were pulled from rural, heavily controlled villages and thrust into the center of a European apocalypse.
It is like pulling back the curtain on The Wizard of Oz. I mean, the entire French colonial narrative in Indochina relied on the myth of absolute, unquestionable European superiority, rationality, and invincibility.
Right.
But in the mud of Verdun, these Indochinese soldiers saw Frenchmen cowering, bleeding, mutinying, and slaughtering each other in a barbaric war. They saw the vulnerability and the sheer desperation of their colonizers.
Furthermore, they worked alongside French laborers in the factories. They were exposed to radical European political movements, trade unionism, socialism, communism.
They engage in debates about egalitarianism and the rights of the working class. Imagine the cognitive dissonance.
It must have been profound.
An Indochinese soldier survives the gas and the artillery of a European war, sheds his blood to defend the French Republic, and then endures a weeks-long ship ride back to Saigon.
And he steps off the boat, and he is immediately expected to step off the sidewalk for a low-level French bureaucrat.
Pay a poll tax and submit to the corvée labor system.
The hypocrisy was blinding. The returning veterans and laborers became the vanguard of a new, highly radicalized resistance. They completely abandoned the idea of restoring the emperor. They wanted a modern nation state.
By the late 1920s, we see the formation of the Vietnamese Nationalist Party, the VNQDD, modeled largely after the Chinese Nationalist Party.
They sought a modern, independent republic through armed revolution. They engineered the Yen Bai Mutiny in 1930. Where Vietnamese soldiers stationed in a French colonial garrison rebelled and killed their French officers.
But the French responded with overwhelming, brutal force.
Yes, the colonial police force, the Sûreté, unleashed a wave of executions and mass imprisonments, effectively crushing the VNQDD leadership.
But as the nationalist movement fractured, a more disciplined, ideologically rigorous force stepped into the void, the communists.
Ho Chi Minh had formed the Vietnamese Revolutionary Youth League in 1925, eventually unifying various communist factions into the Indochinese Communist Party, the ICP, in 1930.
And the ICP offered a framework that the royalists and the early nationalists lapped.
They tied anti-imperialism directly to class struggle. They promised not just to expel the French, but to dismantle the comprador elite, redistribute the massive land holdings to the peasantry, and end the exploitative taxation system.
Which resonated deeply in the rural villages.
Yes, very deeply.
So throughout the 1930s, the pressure cooker is hissing. The French Sûreté is expanding its prison network, like the infamous Pulo Condor Island prison, torturing and hardening thousands of political prisoners.
But while World War I cracked the illusion of French superiority, the geopolitical earthquake of World War II would completely demolish the colonial apparatus.
In June 1940, Nazi Germany invades and defeats France in a matter of weeks. The collaborationist Vichy government takes control in the unoccupied zone of France, and they appoint Admiral Jean de Coux as the governor general of Indochina.
Indochina is suddenly cut off from Paris, isolated, and highly vulnerable. And the Japanese Empire, which has been waging a brutal war in China, immediately sees an opportunity.
In September 1940, Japan demands military access to Tonkin to cut off vital supply routes feeding the Chinese resistance.
Admiral de Coux and the Vichy administration have no leverage. They cave to the Japanese demands. This initiates one of the most bizarre and tense administrative dynamics of the entire war, a co-occupation.
How did that actually work mechanically? I mean, how does a French colonial administrator wake up, put on his uniform, and enforce laws while a foreign military is marching down the street?
It was an exercise in extreme, humiliating defensive realism. The Vichy French retained the civil administration. The French police still patrolled the streets, the French courts still operated, and the French collected the taxes.
But the Japanese military used Indochina as a massive staging ground and resource extraction hub.
Right. They built bases, stationed troops, and dictated overarching strategic policy.
How did the Vichy officials justify this?
They claimed they were saving Indochina from the horrors of a direct, violent Japanese military occupation. They believed that as long as they kept the French flag flying and the bureaucracy running, they were preserving French sovereignty.
Which is why they threw immense energy into youth movements, sports programs, and parades to project a facade of strength and legitimacy.
But the economic reality on the ground was catastrophic. The Vichy administration was forced to sign the Rice Accords, which effectively handed over massive quantities of Indochinese agricultural output to the Japanese war machine.
Japan was requisitioning rice, coal, and rubber at an entirely unsustainable rate.
And the mechanics of this extraction led directly to one of the greatest tragedies in Vietnamese history. The Japanese demanded rice not just to feed their troops, but to burn as fuel for power plants.
Because Allied blockades had cut off their coal and oil shipments.
Exactly. And the French administration ruthlessly enforced these quotas, forcing peasants in the north to stockpile rice for the Japanese.
This systemic extraction, combined with severe typhoons that destroyed the 1944 harvest and Allied bombing raids that decimated the transport infrastructure, triggered a massive, horrific famine in Tonkin and northern Annam between 1944 and 1945.
An estimated 1 million Vietnamese people starved to death.
That is just incomprehensible. 1 million people.
And while the population was dying in the streets, granaries were sitting full of rice guarded by French and Japanese troops, waiting for export.
Throughout this nightmare, both the Vichy French and the Japanese were actively trying to manipulate Vietnamese nationalism.
Yeah, the French were promoting a pro-French Indochinese identity, trying to convince the population that France was their protector.
Meanwhile, the Japanese were broadcasting their Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere propaganda.
Right, encouraging anti-Western sentiment and suggesting that Japan was liberating Asia for Asians.
But this dual manipulation severely backfired on both occupiers. It allowed local nationalist groups the political space to organize, stockpile weapons, and harden their ideologies.
Right-wing nationalist groups, such as the Ivet parties, aligned with the Japanese, while the communists quietly built vast intelligence and guerrilla networks in the rural mountainous regions.
The population learned a brutal lesson. Neither the French nor the Japanese viewed them as human beings.
And the fragile co-occupation finally shatters in early 1945.
The Allies are advancing rapidly across the Pacific. Paris has been liberated by the Allies.
And the Japanese military command correctly deduces that the Vichy administration in Indochina is shifting its loyalty to Charles de Gaulle's Free French Forces.
They fear the French garrison will turn their guns on the Japanese to aid an imminent Allied invasion.
So the Japanese launch a preemptive decapitation strike, Operation Mago, March 9, 1945.
Let's set the scene for that evening. French officers are sitting down to dinner in Hanoi and Saigon.
The Japanese ambassador issues a sudden ultimatum to Admiral Decoux, demanding the immediate transfer of all military and police command to Japanese forces.
But before Decoux can organize a coherent response, 55,000 Japanese troops launch a coordinated, overwhelming assault across the entire Indochinese Union.
They strike French military garrisons, police stations, and administrative buildings simultaneously. Within 24 hours, the Japanese entirely dismantle an administrative apparatus that had controlled the region for 87 years.
French civil leaders and military commanders, including Admiral Decoux, are dragged from their offices and thrown into internment camps. Thousands of French soldiers who resist are killed, and the rest are captured.
The Japanese immediately attempt to install a native puppet government. They declare the independence of the Empire of Vietnam and place Emperor Bei at its head.
But the political reality of this puppet state is irrelevant compared to the structural consequence of Operation Mago.
Exactly. The true consequence is the vacuum. By decapitating the Vichy government, neutralizing the French military, and destroying the Sûreté police network, the Japanese inadvertently cleared the board.
They removed the entire machinery of colonial oppression in a single night.
And Japan's victory over the French was essentially meaningless because just 5 months later, in August 1945, atomic bombs are dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
The Japanese Empire surrenders to the Allies.
So the Japanese troops stationed in Indochina are suddenly a defeated, demoralized army with no orders.
While the French administration is still locked behind barbed wire in the internment camps.
Right, a massive, unprecedented power vacuum opens across Indochina. And stepping directly into that void is Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh.
The Viet Minh, the League for the Independence of Vietnam, was formed by Ho Chi Minh in 1941.
It was designed as a broad, united front. Ho Chi Minh strategically de-emphasized strict communist class warfare in favor of a universal message of national liberation.
Aiming to unite peasants, intellectuals, and even moderate landlords against the foreign occupiers.
Throughout the war, the Viet Minh had been operating from hidden bases in the mountainous northern borderlands. They built highly disciplined guerrilla units, established intelligence networks, and most importantly, they engaged in constant political cadres training in the villages.
So when Japan surrenders in August, the Viet Minh are the only organized, legitimate political force capable of seizing control.
And they launched the August Revolution.
The mechanics of the August Revolution reveal incredible strategic brilliance, because the Viet Minh didn't just rely on armed force, they used the chaos of the famine.
Yeah, they organized peasants to break open the Japanese and French rice granaries and distribute the food to the starving population.
That action alone secured them overwhelming, unquestioning loyalty from the rural masses. They didn't just promise liberation, they delivered immediate survival.
They mobilize massive crowds and sweep into the major urban centers. They take control of Hanoi on August 19th.
And the Japanese army, waiting to be formally disarmed by the Allies, adopts a largely passive stance.
Aside from a brief skirmish in Tai Nguyen, where the Viet Minh force a Japanese garrison to surrender, the transfer of power in the cities is remarkably bloodless.
The speed and popular support of the Viet Minh leave the Japanese puppet government entirely paralyzed.
Recognizing the reality on the ground, Emperor Bao Nai officially abdicates the throne on August 25.
He formally hands over the imperial seal and sword to representatives of the Viet Minh. He actually stated he would rather be a common citizen of an independent country than the emperor of a subjugated one.
Which peacefully and officially terminates the ancient Vietnamese monarchy.
And that culminates in one of the most significant diplomatic maneuvers of the 20th century, on September 2, 1945.
Ho Chi Minh stands before a crowd of hundreds of thousands in Ba Dinh Square in Hanoi. He reads the Declaration of Independence, officially establishing the Democratic Republic of Vietnam.
Just picture the absolute surreal nature of this moment. He's proclaiming a sovereign, independent nation to a massive, jubilant crowd.
While just a few miles away, the French colonial administrators who ruled them 6 months prior are still locked inside Japanese prisons, listening to the crowd's cheer.
Ho Chi Minh established a de facto government before the Allied powers even had time to realize what was happening. But the text of his declaration is what is truly fascinating.
He doesn't open by quoting Karl Marx or Lenin.
Right. He directly quotes the American Declaration of Independence. All men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And he quotes the French Declaration of the Rights of Man. What is the strategic calculation behind using the foundational texts of the colonizers against them on the world stage?
It is a calculated, highly sophisticated diplomatic appeal. Ho Chi Minh knew the French would attempt to return, and he knew he needed international recognition to stop them.
By quoting Thomas Jefferson, he was signaling directly to the United States.
Exactly, a nation that had just fought a world war in the name of self-determination and democracy. He was saying that the Vietnamese struggle was identical to the American Revolution. He was daring the French and the Americans to deny Vietnam the very democratic principles they claimed to champion.
It sets up a massive historical counterfactual. What if the Allied powers had listened? What if the United States had recognized Ho Chi Minh's Democratic Republic of Vietnam in 1945?
It is entirely possible that decades of catastrophic warfare, millions of deaths, and the subsequent American involvement in the Vietnam War could have been entirely avoided. Ho Chi Minh was signaling a willingness to integrate into the post-war international order as an independent state.
But geopolitics is rarely dictated by ideals. At the Potsdam Conference earlier that summer, the Allied leaders had already drawn lines on a map to decide the fate of Indochina.
They agreed to temporarily partition the region at the 16th parallel, purely for the logistical purpose of disarming the defeated Japanese army.
And that logistical decision guaranteed that the triumphant moment in Ba Dinh Square would be fleeting. The Allied partition paved the way for the return of foreign armies, which ignited a brutal, protracted conflict.
The post-war occupation was a logistical nightmare. South of the 16th parallel, British troops arrive in Saigon in September 1945.
Their official mandate is strictly to disarm the Japanese.
But the British commander on the ground, General Douglas Gracie, is deeply hostile to the Viet Minh insurgency. He fears a communist takeover.
So Gracie actively facilitates the return of French forces.
Yes, he releases the French troops from their internment camps, rearms them, and even temporarily uses surrender Japanese troops to violently suppress the Viet Minh and secure Saigon for the returning French administration.
Meanwhile, north of the 16th parallel, the situation is completely different. Nearly 200,000 Chinese nationalist troops under Chiang Kai-shek cross the border to disarm the Japanese in Tonkin.
The Chinese have historical animosity toward the French, and they refuse to allow the French military to immediately return to Hanoi.
This Chinese occupation was brutal and highly corrupt. They looted the region heavily, but strategically, it shielded the Viet Minh.
It prevented the French from immediately crushing Ho Chi Minh's fragile new government, giving the Viet Minh several crucial months to consolidate their political control, print currency, and train their forces in the north.
But the French are determined to reclaim their empire. They eventually negotiate a withdrawal of the Chinese troops, bringing the French military face to face with the Viet Minh.
There are attempts at diplomacy. Ho Chi Minh signs the Ho-Saint-Ting Agreement in March 1946, which allows a limited number of French troops to enter the North in exchange for France recognizing Vietnam as a free state within the French Union.
But the definitions were fundamentally incompatible. For Ho Chi Minh, a free state meant full sovereignty, control over foreign policy, and a unified Vietnam, including Cochin China.
For the French, a free state just meant local autonomy, while France retained absolute control over the military, the economy, and customs revenues. They refused to let go of Cochin China, the economic engine.
So the diplomatic conferences at Dalat and Fontainebleau completely collapse over these contradictions. Tensions escalate. Troops are mobilizing.
And the powder keg officially ignites in November 1946 over a dispute regarding customs control in the northern port city of Haiphong.
The Viet Minh and French troops clash over who has the right to collect tariffs.
And the local French commander decides to teach the Viet Minh a lesson. He orders French naval vessels to open fire on the city.
The naval bombardment of Haiphong is devastating. French cruisers pour artillery fire into the densely populated urban center, killing approximately 6,000 Vietnamese civilians in a matter of hours.
It was an act of massive, disproportionate violence intended to terrorize the Viet Minh into submission. Instead, it guaranteed all-out war.
A month later, in December 1946, the Battle of Hanoi erupts. The Viet Minh launch coordinated attacks against French positions in the city.
The French respond with overwhelming artillery and armor.
Realizing they cannot hold the urban centers against heavy conventional firepower, the Viet Minh execute a strategic withdrawal.
They pull their forces out of Hanoi and retreat into the dense, mountainous jungles of the Viet Bec region to begin a protracted guerrilla campaign. The First Indochina War has begun.
This war, lasting from 1946 to 1954, is defined by a massive strategic and conceptual mismatch.
The French military command fought a conventional war. They deployed armored columns, paratrooper battalions, and relied heavily on air superiority. Their defining strategy was the hedgehog concept.
Can you explain the mechanics of the hedgehog strategy?
The French would identify critical strategic intersections, valleys, or supply routes. They would heavily fortify these areas with concrete bunkers, artillery, and massive troop concentrations, creating a heavily armed hedgehog that bristled with defenses.
It's General Jean de Lattre de Tassigny even built the de Lattre Line.
Right, a massive string of concrete blockhouses designed to completely seal off the Red River Delta and protect the vital rice harvests and urban centers from Viet Minh infiltration.
But building massive static concrete forts to fight a highly mobilized guerrilla insurgency is like trying to catch water with a net.
It really is. The French could hold the physical ground their bunker sat on. They could control the major paved roads during the day. But the vast, fluid ocean of the rural population just flowed right around them.
The reality on the ground was stark. The French controlled the cities, but the Viet Minh owned the countryside.
And the Viet Minh military commander, General Von Nguyen Giap, was a brilliant tactician utilizing a Maoist-inspired strategy of protracted people's war.
How does that strategy counter French artillery?
By entirely avoiding it. Giap refused to engage in large-scale pitched battles where French firepower would dominate. Instead, he relied on constant grinding hit-and-run ambushes.
So Viet Minh guerrillas would attack an isolated French patrol, inflict casualties, and immediately melt back into the jungle or blend into the local villages.
The strategy relies entirely on the political mobilization of the peasantry. The villages provided the intelligence, the food, and the recruits, creating a logistical network that the French could never map or destroy.
The war grinds into a brutal deadlock. France is hemorrhaging money and men. And France is not fighting this alone.
No, as the Cold War intensifies, the United States views the conflict through the lens of containment, seeing the Viet Minh not as nationalist freedom fighters, but as agents of global communism.
By 1954, the United States is deeply involved, funding up to 80% of the total French war effort.
Furthermore, France is utilizing the manpower of its broader empire. The French Expeditionary Corps is heavily composed of troops drawn from North Africa, Moroccans, Algerians, as well as Senegalese tirailleurs, and thousands of hardened mercenaries in the French Foreign Legion.
Yet, despite massive American financial backing, modern aircraft, and a multinational army, the French cannot break the insurgency, and the strategic balance shifts drastically in 1949.
When the Chinese Communist Party wins the Chinese Civil War.
The establishment of the People's Republic of China on Vietnam's northern border changes everything.
Giap now has a massive, secure rear base. The Chinese begin supplying the Viet Minh with heavy artillery, modern infantry weapons, and crucial logistical training. The Viet Minh are transforming from a light guerrilla force into a conventional modern army.
Which brings us to the defining catastrophic climax of the era, the Battle of Dien Bien Phu in 1954.
The French military command, desperate to break the deadlock and secure a decisive victory to strengthen their hand at upcoming peace talks, decides on a massive gamble.
They identify a remote, bowl-shaped valley in northwestern Vietnam near the Laotian border called Dien Bien Phu.
The French strategy was an extreme application of the hedgehog concept. They believed if they dropped a massive force into this valley, they could cut off Viet Minh supply lines into Laos.
And forced General Giap into the open set-piece battle they had been craving for 8 years.
They assumed that once Giap attacked the valley, superior French artillery and air support would obliterate the Viet Minh forces.
They parachute 10,800 crack French Union troops, legionnaires, paratroopers, colonial infantry into the valley. They build an airstrip, fortify the low hills, and wait.
But their entire plan rested on a fatal assumption regarding logistics. They assumed the terrain was too rugged for the Viet Minh to bring heavy artillery through the jungle.
The French commander of artillery at Dien Bien Phu, Colonel Charles Pirroth, famously boasted that the Viet Minh would not be able to drag more than a few light pieces to the valley, and if they did, his counter-battery fire would destroy them within minutes.
General Giap's response is one of the most astonishing logistical feats in modern military history. He doesn't just attack the base, he completely surrounds it.
He mobilizes tens of thousands of peasant laborers. They construct completely hidden, camouflaged roads through the dense jungle canopy.
The mechanics of this are mind-boggling. The Viet Minh dismantled heavy, American-made howitzers captured in the Korean War and supplied by China into individual pieces.
Peasants manually haul these massive steel components using ropes, pulleys, and heavily reinforced bicycles over 260 kilometers of mountainous terrain.
They drag them inch by inch up the steep hills directly overlooking the French positions in the valley.
They amass 50,000 combat troops around the valley, outnumbering the French 5-1. And they dig intricate trench systems that inch closer and closer to the French wire every night.
On March 13, 1954, Giap springs the trap.
The French are entirely caught off guard. The Viet Minh unleash a massive coordinated artillery barrage from the surrounding hills.
Because the artillery is dug into deep, camouflaged caves on the reverse slopes of the mountains, the French cannot locate them to return fire.
Colonel Pirroth, realizing his fatal miscalculation and the impending destruction of his forces, commits suicide in his bunker.
Within days, the Viet Minh artillery destroys the French airstrip.
That is the moment the battle is lost. The French strategy relied entirely on aerial resupply.
With the airstrip destroyed, the French garrison is completely cut off, relying on highly inaccurate parachute drops that often land directly in Viet Minh trenches.
The battle descends into a horrific, muddy, bloody siege reminiscent of World War I trench warfare.
For 2 months, the French fight desperately in the monsoon rain, suffering massive casualties from disease and relentless bombardment.
On May 7, 1954, the Viet Minh launch a final, overwhelming assault and overrun the central command bunker. The remaining French garrison surrenders.
The fall of Dien Bien Phu sent absolute shockwaves across the globe. A colonized indigenous army had just decisively defeated a modern, industrialized Western military in a massive, conventional set-piece battle.
It permanently shattered the myth of Western military invincibility. It became the ultimate blueprint and inspiration for anti-colonial struggles from Algeria to Africa.
For France, it was the definitive death knell. The psychological shock broke the political will of the French public and government to continue the war.
The narrative instantly shifts from the blood-soaked valley of Dien Bien Phu to the diplomatic tables in Switzerland to formalize the end of an empire.
The 1954 Geneva Conference was convened to settle the Indochina question. The resulting Geneva Accords officially dissolved French Indochina. The colonial apparatus constructed by Paul Daumer was legally erased from the map.
The Accords recognized the full sovereign independence of the Kingdom of Cambodia and the Kingdom of Laos. As for Vietnam, it was temporarily partitioned at the 17th parallel.
Ho Chi Minh's Viet Minh took control of the newly recognized Democratic Republic of Vietnam in the north. The south remained under a non-communist government backed by the United States.
The partition was meant to be temporary, pending national reunification elections in 1956.
But those elections were never held, because the Southern government and its American backers knew Ho Chi Minh would win decisively. This failure to reunify directly set the stage for the catastrophic Second Indochina War, the Vietnam War.
The French Empire collapsed, but the artificial borders they drew left deep, permanent scars on the region. Which brings us to a final thought based on the history we've unpacked today. Look closely at the fate of Laos.
Yes, Laos.
Early French administrators viewed Laos as an economically unviable territory. It was largely landlocked, mountainous, and lacked the massive rice deltas of Cochin China.
The French didn't build the extensive canal networks there, nor did they establish massive Michelin River plantations.
For the French, Laos was merely a strategic buffer state, kept mostly to prevent British expansion from Burma, and for the sheer vanity of painting more of the map in French imperial colors.
It was an administrative afterthought, defined by borders drawn purely for colonial convenience.
Yet, those exact artificial borders, drawn to contain an unviable space, ended up dictating the lines of one of the most brutal geopolitical conflicts of the 20th century.
During the subsequent Vietnam War, because of where those lines were drawn on the map, the North Vietnamese utilized the Laotian borderlands to create the Ho Chi Minh Trail logistics network.
In response, the United States launched a massive secret bombing campaign. Laos, the colonial afterthought, became the most heavily bombed country per capita in the history of human warfare.
Over 2 million tons of ordnance were dropped on it.
It forces us to confront a haunting reality. Lines drawn on a map in a distant European capital, drawn merely for bureaucratic convenience or imperial ego, possess a terrifying longevity.
Long after the French administrators fled, long after the colonial empire crumbled to dust, those arbitrary lines continued to dictate the violent destiny of millions.
The map might just be a fragile piece of paper, but the scars it cuts into the earth are permanent. Thank you for listening. History Maps. Learn history visually.